Sunday, we talked about where do you get the power to do what's in the letters? Where do you get the power to live the Christian life? And the statement I found in the Gospels, the power to do what's in the letters, was made kind of a theme for that lesson. Would you say that with me this morning? I have found in the Gospels the power to do what's in the letters. And we even asked and found the answer as to why that's true. And it's true because we become like what we love. 2 Corinthians 3:18 says we are being transformed. We all with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into His likeness from one degree of glory to another. And it's one of those consequences that you can't avoid. You cannot avoid becoming like what you worship. You cannot avoid becoming like that which is your God, or He who is your God. And if God is your God, if Christ is your God, with unveiled face, beholding Him, you're going to become like Him. That's a promise. It's one of those universal principles that's so true, you can't avoid becoming like what you love. The question for this morning is, what do you do in the meantime? What do you do in the meantime from point A, where we are, untogether, broken? What do you do from this point up to this point where He wants us to be? What happens in here in the meantime? How do you live your life with assurance while you're on the way to wholeness? And that's a big question for Christians. Some people have resigned themselves to live without any assurance. And I'm sorry for that, that that's the case, but it's true. There's some who've resigned themselves to just grit it out, grind and grit their teeth, and just hang on without any assurance. And I'm sorry that that often has been the way of thinking of the church. Other people play games. Some people play the game of playthrough. They wear masks. They wear masks that even fool themselves. And when you ask them, how are you doing? Oh, great. Praise the Lord. Hallelujah. And they go through all this litany and all this rigmarole of, and we know really that it probably isn't that good. Others play the game of pray through. Did you ever play that game? I have. I've played the game of pray through. I remember once in Little Rock, Arkansas, back in 1963, four. Ooh, that's 40 years ago. I remember being frustrated with not being able to feel that I was praying adequately. And I couldn't figure out what the problem was. And I just got so frustrated, I went into my office one day and shut the door, and I locked it, and I said, I'm not coming out until I pray through. Well, I raised my head, and I clasped my hand, and I prayed, and I prayed, and don't you know, it started happening. I mean, I got to where I was feeling like I was going to swoon. And then I thought, you better lower your head, you dummy. You shut the blood off from your brain. And I realized, well, you know, that must not be a part of it. Others play the game of penance. You know, if you miss one Wednesday night, you'll attend two the next week or somewhere. You'll kind of like the Lions Club or the Kiwanis. You go somewhere up to make up. And people spend their lives playing the game of penance like you're going to finally end up hoping that you've got enough balancing the other out to where you finally squeak in at the last minute. Let me tell you, the Christian's got something better than that going for him. These are just games that you play. Games that are foolish, they're futile, they're fanciful, and they're fatal. And they're going to deal misery to you if you don't learn to do something better than depend on these superficial ways of feeling like you're okay. How do you live with assurance? How do you live knowing that you're okay with God even when you're not living up to the things that are required of you in the letters? You know you're not there yet. This morning I want us to answer that. And the answer simply is this. Today we're going to look at, I find in the Gospels the assurance that I'm okay with God even when I miss the mark. Will you say that with me? I have found in the gospel the assurance that I'm okay with God even when I miss the mark. You realize what you just said? You little rascal, you just confessed. You just confessed that you believe you're okay with God even when you sin. Now, that's what the brother at the table said. There's not anything you can do that's going to cut you off from the family. Let me just make sure. This is being taped, is it? Is this being taped? Yeah. Do I dare do this? Do I dare tell the people who listen to this tape? Do I dare identify you? You went on record just now and said that you believe that you're okay with God even when you sin. Shall I tell them the name of the church or not? You want to? You see, this church grew up in a tradition that came near a teaching, instead of saying once saved, always saved. Our Baptist cousins say, you know, they harp on that, and we know that that's kind of pushing it to the extreme. We come near saying once saved, always in doubt. I'm telling you that I don't know what I'd rather be over here is over there. But there's a middle ground that's probably more biblical than either of those, and that's once saved, always confident. Once saved, always confident. Now, I can live with that. That's what we're going to be looking at this morning. But how do you go about that? How can I be confident that I'm okay with God? How can I live with that kind of confidence? Okay, let me just give you this that we're going to say this morning. I can know God's attitude toward us or toward me when I fail once I discover what Jesus' attitude was toward his disciples when they failed. Now think about it. In just a minute we're going to look at a diagram, but I can know God's attitude toward me when I fail if I can ever just discover what Jesus' attitude was toward his disciples when they failed. Does that make sense? Let me show you what I mean by it. Here is what you call the principle of triangulation. This represents, of course, whom? That's Jesus. Who do we see when we see Jesus? Who do we see when we see him? We see God. Jesus said, if you've seen me, what? You've seen the Father. So here's Jesus. He represents and shows us God. Here are the disciples, the 12. We can read in the Gospels and know how he treated them. That's what we're going to talk about this morning. Well, we identify with them. I'm a disciple. Are you a disciple? Are all of you? Raise your hand if you're a disciple of Jesus Christ. Okay. If you are a disciple, they are disciples here, then if you know how Jesus treated them, and you're one of them, then you know how Jesus treats you when you sin. Now that's called the principle of triangulation. That's a nautical term. Sailors out on the sea want to know how far they are from the shoal or the rocks. And they know that there's a lighthouse over here, and they know that there's something over here. They know where that is, and they know how far they are from that. So here we go. It's the principle of triangulation. Let me state it again. We can know what God's attitude is toward us when we sin if we can figure out what Jesus' attitude toward the disciples was when they sinned. Now we can just dismiss if you want to. Go on. Okay. We're going to choose the one that's the one of the 12 that's the most visible, the most vocal, and you already got him, and the most vulnerable of all the 12, and his name is Simon Peter. Boy, Simon was forever, well, not always. He didn't always have his foot in his mouth. When he changed feet, he didn't have them in his mouth. That's about the only time he didn't. But there's this man, and there's more said about him than any of the other disciples as far as the interaction between him and Jesus. There's more said about him, and I think it's because he's so much like us. When I look at Simon Peter, I see so much of me in Simon Peter and so much of Simon Peter in me that I know if the Lord can put up with him, I'm sure he can put up with me because I'm a disciple too, and I'm a lot like Simon Peter. There are four areas in Simon Peter's life, four incidents in his life with which you and I can identify that I want us to consider this morning. Number one, there were times in Simon Peter's life when he had terrible feelings of unworthiness. This came out first when he was fishing once or what rather Jesus was teaching, and he was using Simon Peter's boat as a podium or as a roster. And when he finished preaching, he told Simon, put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch. So Simon said, well, we worked all night and caught nothing, but at your word, we'll do that. So he went out into the deep water, let down his net, and he felt something that was terribly unfamiliar to him. There was such a load of fish he had never felt before. So many that the nets began to break. So many that when they filled that boat and it began to sink, he whistled for James and John and said, come help us. They started filling that second boat. Both of them began. And Peter just knew he had never seen anything like that before. And he fell down on his knees. And he said, Lord, get away from me. I'm a sinful man. Have you ever felt like that before yourself? That you're not worth all that you get, all that you've received? When you look at your family, you look at your children, you look at the fact that you've got maybe something other than enough money to get you through the end of the week or the end of the month, you look at the house you live in, you look at the fact that you've got clothes, that you've got gas, all this that you've got, all the physical things, it seems to me that one of the most often occurrences of this feeling of unworthiness is when I'm surrounded by things that are so wonderful. Good job, whatever you want to point to, you realize, you know, I don't deserve this. And I feel like I'm so unworthy. I'm so unworthy, Lord, get away from me. That's the way Peter was feeling. Jesus could have said, Simon, you don't know the half of it. You are the filthiest mouth fisherman I've ever heard. You have the quickest temper and the shortest fuse. He could have listed a whole bunch of things that Simon didn't even know about himself. But he didn't. But I'll tell you what he did do. He told him two words that I hang my hat on every day. Two words after Simon said, get away from me. I'm a sinful man. Jesus said, don't be afraid. And from now on. Can you believe that? Don't be afraid from now on. And I tell you what, I have to hang my hat there because I've made so many mistakes so many times and feel so unworthy. If it were not for the fact that I serve a God and I live as the disciple of a man who made it his practice to say, don't be afraid, you know, it's all right, and then just completely dismiss it and say, from now on, we're going to catch people. We're going to catch men. We're going to catch women. We're going to catch people, little children. We're going to catch folks. You're going to quit fishing for fish, and you're going to start catching people. I tell you what, preaching to people, he's done that to me for 50 years. He's told me, don't be afraid. From now on, I'm going to use you to talk to folks. And look at him. Here we are today. He's still doing it after 50 years. He's still saying to me, don't be afraid. From now on, you're going to be catching people. Now listen, when you feel so terribly unworthy, and I said don't point it at people's eyes, but I could just do like this and get every one of you, everybody in here, everybody in this assembly feels unworthy. And let me just tell you what Jesus said. Don't be afraid. From now on, I've got things for you to do. My goodness, that's good news. Well, there's a second time when Peter illustrates for us this good news that we're okay with God even when we miss the mark, even when we sin, even when we don't measure up. That's when his faith failed him. You remember when he was out on the water, they had left the east coast of the Sea of Galilee, were on the way back over to Capernaum. And Jesus went up into the mountains to pray. It was after the feeding of the 5,000. And they were already about 2 or 3 miles out into the water. And Jesus came walking to them on the water, on the lake. And the disciples saw him and scared the daylights out of him. They thought he was a ghost. And they started yelling and screaming. And Jesus again said, don't be afraid. It's just me. It's me. Peter said, Lord, if it's you, tell me to come walking on the water to you. Jesus says, come on. Well, he put that number 12 over the gunwale, and here he went. and went out there to meet him and was doing it. But it says that when he saw the waves and the water and the wind and the mist and all that, he took his eye off the Lord and started looking at that was around him. And he made a good start, but he made a poor finish. Have you ever done that? You're far enough away from him, and yet close enough too to remember your New Year's resolution. I'm not going to eat that second plate. I'm not going to spend that other dollar. And yet here you've already broken it, and now what you got to do? Your faith has failed you. You started off well, but you finished poorly. Now you're back in the same mess you were before the end of the year, and you don't know what must he think about you when your faith isn't strong enough to carry you through your resolution. Well, what must he think? Well, what did he do for Simon? First thing he did for him was rescue him. It said he reached down and grabbed him. He didn't let him drown. He reached down and stopped the descent, grabbed him, pulled him up. And I don't know how they got back in the boat. They must have both walked on the water to get back in. I don't know. But it seemed as he put his arm around him and said, "Oh, you have little faith. Why did you doubt? You know, you were doing good. Why did you doubt?" Well, it was all that stuff that came in that was around him when the billows started rolling in. How many of you have said, I'm going to tithe this year. I'm going to give a tenth of what I'm not going to give less than what the law requires. I'm going to do that. But when the billows start rolling in, how many of you then have said, "Well, I just don't think I can do it this week," and once you've broken the habit of doing it, and your faith that God, when he says, "I will provide every need, every need, every need, and I will give you bread, and I'll give you seed for sowing, and I will increase your harvest," and all of that that he tells us, and we forget that and we think, "But Lord, those billows are all around me. I just don't think I can." I remember when I was 18 years old and was starting to work at Union Avenue as a youth minister leading singing there, I made up my mind I'm going to start giving a tenth of my goods, a tenth of my income. I made $150 a month. And the first time that the plate came by, I don't know quite what it was, but I'd already paid all my bills, and I had exactly $15 left, and here came the plate. And I began to sweat. I began to perspire, because that's all I had, and there was 30 days ahead of me left. Well, I reached in there, and there was that $15, fat and heavy, and I thought, well, I just started stewing and fuming. And then I came to this conclusion. I said, if it's not worth living for, and it's not worth giving for, it's not worth living for. So I just took that money out and threw it by the plate and said, you know, I said, get on. The dismissal prayer, 5 minutes later now, if it was even 5 minutes, here came this little woman on a cane down the middle aisle, and she came and she had something in her hand, and I put my hand out, and she laid a great big $10 bill in my hand. 5 minutes after I made the decision that I was going to do what I'd committed to do. From that day on to this, I have never doubted of what God would do exactly what he said he would do when it comes to our giving. Have you ever backed off your giving because you just, you know, didn't have it to give? Well, this sermon wasn't on giving, but it's one of those things where our faith, your faith, by the way, is mostly, it's very accurately reflected in your checkbook. You know that? How strong is your faith? Go and look at your checkbook. It's the most obvious and tangible way for you to decide what do you really trust in and what do you really want. Scratch that. This isn't even a sermon on giving, but I can't help it. I just thought of it, and I just feel like it has to be said. Okay, but God rescued Peter before the waves, before the billows swallowed him, and before the billows swallow you. He'll rescue you. You just do what you know you ought to do. He'll rescue you. Cry out. He's not far away. Okay, a third place. Third place was when Simon Peter had this gross misunderstanding about the gospel, about the good news. You see, these men didn't catch it. They didn't get it for about 3 years. they heard him tell all these stories. They saw him do all these marvelous signs and wonders that he did, but they still didn't get it. After about 2 years, they were on their way from, where was it? Caesarea, they were on their way down from the north, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "Well, some say Elijah, or some Jeremiah, one of the prophets." And then Jesus said, "But who do you say I am?" And here was Peter speaking again. First, Peter said, "You're the Christ, the Son of God." And Jesus said, "Blessed are you, Simon, for making this confession." He said, "This wasn't revealed to you by man. This was revealed to you from my Father. And upon this rock, the fact that he's the Son of God, he said, I'm going to build my church." Well, then next he said, he began to tell them that he had to go to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the hands of the priests and the elders there, and be crucified, and he would be raised. Well, Peter, once he heard that word crucified, he didn't hear anything else. He took him aside, it says. The scripture says he took him aside and began to what? Rebuke him. To begin to rebuke him. Now, you don't rebuke anybody with your hands in your pocket. You may correct them and you may converse with them, but you don't rebuke them. You rebuke them with your finger in their face. He said, "That will never happen, Lord." Peter knew so little. He understood so little. Bless his heart, I don't know how God put up with it. Jesus said, you better get behind me, Satan. You make me sick. He said, "You're not on the side of men. You're on the side of God. You're on the side of men." And he just spanked him, gave him a good spanking right there in front of him. One of the Gospels says Jesus turned and saw the other disciples watching at this interchange between Jesus and Peter. He turned and saw the disciples and knew, well, I better put a stop to this quick. And he just corrected him, called him Satan, said, "Get behind me, you make me sick." Well, what on earth would he do with that man who had such a shallow understanding of the Gospel? Do you know of anybody that has some gross misunderstandings of the Gospel? Yeah, you see, there's a church right down the street here that they have the strangest attitude toward the second coming I've ever heard. It's amazing. And then there's one on down the street from that. They have a strange attitude toward signs and miracles and tongues. No, I'm talking about people back this side of those folks. Well, I got an uncle that died 2 years ago, and he had some weird ideas, too. No, closer than that. Oh, you're talking about my wife. Yes, she has some strange ideas. No, closer home than that. I'm talking about you and me. You and I have such gross misunderstandings about the good news. And our misunderstandings are not so much erroneous as they are just surface. There's another word, superfluous, is not what I mean. That means in addition to superfluous, but not just erroneous. They're not erroneous. We don't have any great erroneous false doctrine, but it's the shallowness of our perception that's what caught us. And we talk about little things. We make so much to do about molehills, and our divisions come over things that don't amount to a hill of beans. We don't divide over the deity of Christ. We don't divide over the presence of God, and we don't divide over any of these things. We don't divide over how essential it is to be a Christian. We don't divide over things like that. You know what we've divided over? You do know, and I'm not even going to embarrass us to mention them today, but they're just tiny, tiny molehills in the midst of these huge mountains. We have such a gross misunderstanding. You and I both do. What must he say about it? How does he put up with us? How does he not just simply cut us off and say, "Okay, I've had it with you"? But watch what he did with Simon Peter. After Peter made this faw-paw and corrected Jesus and rebuked him, it says in chapter 17 of Matthew 17:1, the very next incident, it says, 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John. He said, "Come on, I want to show you something." And you can just think about James and John, as explosive as they were, these sons of thunder. I can just imagine them saying, "Oh Lord, surely you're not going to ask Peter to go with us. He just blew it over there 6 days ago. He can't see through a ladder. Why would you take him?" But the fact of the matter is that he said to Peter, whom he had just gotten through calling Satan, whom you had just gotten through saying, you're not on God's side, you're on men's side, who just got through telling him, get behind me, you make me sick. He said, come on, Peter, I want to show you something. And he took them up in the Mount of Transfiguration, and in all of his glory manifested himself to this man whose foot was constantly in his mouth, whose mind was seldom engaged, and there he said, here, I want you to see something. And Peter never forgot it. 30 years later, he wrote in his first letter that we heard this voice on the holy mountain when we were with him. We heard the voice of God say, this is my son, listen to him. That was Simon Peter. Now he'll do the same thing for you and me. He has done the same thing for you and me. In all of your misunderstandings, in all of my shallowness, in all of whatever it is that has kept me from seeing the absolute essentiality and the nature of the good news that God came among men, in the midst of my failing to preach on the resurrection for the first 15 years of my life, the first 15 years of my ministry, I did not preach a sermon on the resurrection. I don't know how to explain that. I don't know how to explain that he put up with me during all those years when I was addressing all those other issues. And I ignored the one that's at the very base of our whole faith. Well, then there's a fourth area. That's when Peter just absolutely, flatly, outright denied it. You know the story. He was telling them how he was going to have to go to Jerusalem. And Peter said, I'm willing to go and die with you. I'm willing to go to prison for you. I'm willing to even die with you. Jesus said, Peter, before the cock crows this very day, you're going to deny that you know me 3 times. And Peter said, I won't either. Jesus didn't argue with him. He said, I've prayed for you that your faith may not fail. But he said, when you've turned again, you strengthen your brethren. But Peter then, Jesus just let him stew and fume. How many times have you said, I'll never do that? Or I'll never do that again? Oh, if I were to ask you to raise your hand with me, everybody in here would have to raise your hand because you've done the same thing over and over and over again. And you think, well, Lord God, here I am again. Here I am doing it again. What must he think about you? What must he think of you? Look at you. Many of you, most of you perhaps, have a Christian background. You've got Christian mothers and daddies. And here you are maybe acting like you're acting. And you said, here I am again. What must he think about you? Let me show you what he thought about Simon Peter. This is one of the most precious passages in the Bible. Turn to Mark, the 16th chapter, and look at verse 7, and you want to underline it because this is so vitally important. Mark, the 16th chapter, and verse 7. This is the resurrection scene. And here, more than once, they're being told, don't be alarmed, don't be afraid. Don't be scared. This was one of the most often used expressions because trying to interface the divine with the human required the humans to be told, it's all right, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. And so in verse 6 it says, again, don't be alarmed, he said. You're looking for Jesus of Nazareth who was crucified. He's risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him? But go tell his disciples and what? And Peter. Well, why would he need to do that? Because I suspect Simon Peter feels about the same way about himself that you feel about yourself and me, the way I feel about myself. Peter felt he'd stepped over the line. You know full well Simon Peter felt like that he had stepped over the line. He denied him 3 times. And he just probably felt like, there's no use for me. I'm not, you boys go on, I'm not. He doesn't want me anymore. So Jesus told this messenger, go tell my disciples, I'll meet them in Galilee. But he said, and tell my disciples and Peter. be sure to tell Peter. Because whenever the messenger came and told them in, Peter, you can just see him kind of wandering around with his hands in his pocket. And they said, Peter, come on. He said, well, no, that means you all. He's not. Oh, he said to tell us and to tell you to meet him in Galilee. Man, if that isn't good news for those of us who consistently seem to not be able to get ourselves out of this pull of the flesh. And you've gone back to smoking, and you've gone back to dipping, and you've gone back to chewing, and you've gone back to lusting, and you've gone back to lying, and you've gone back to cheating on your taxes, and you've done it again. What must he think about? Well, if you'll do like Simon Peter did, if it cuts you to the heart, he's a whole lot more committed to you than you are committed to him. Now think about it. He's a whole lot more committed to us than we are committed to him. Well, you mean to tell me that even when our faith fails and when we feel unworthy and when, what is the third one? Misunderstanding and then our denial. You mean through all of this, he still hangs on to us? That's right. Now let me ask you a question. What makes you think that he loves them more than he loves you? Aren't you a disciple? Yes, you just confessed. You're a disciple. Well, he showed how much he loved them and how much he put up with them and how far he went with them. He'll go that same distance with you. And you teenagers, let me tell you, there are times in your life when you're going to think, there's no use praying for me. I've already stepped over the line. And there's some of you, those of us who are married and who are older and adults, there are going to be many more times when you think the same thing. There's no hope for me. Oh, but that's where you're wrong. There is hope for you. And that's what, there are two things I want to show you today. There are two more of these slides. Put that other one up here. While we're being transformed into his likeness, we're being assured of his approval or his favor. It's in this process, while we're being transformed, we can be assured of his favor. That's what I meant by this one. The second one we started off with. And I want you to change it. We've got it here. It's we find in the gospel. I'm going to ask that you read this with me, but I want you to put I, because it's not we, really. It gets down to me. I have found. Say it with me. I find in the gospel the assurance that I'm okay with God even when I miss the mark. Now, at first I tricked you into saying it. Are you any more confident in saying that now than you were at the beginning of this hour? One man out after the first service, he was walking and he looked like an old cowboy. And he said, thank you for that sermon. He said, you make me even like myself. It makes me even like myself. Can you imagine the burden that reflects? There's a song that we're going to sing. I wandered far away from God. Lord, I'm coming home. There may be somebody here today that has been so relieved to realize it's possible for me to feel good about myself and to know that God loves me. I want you to read one verse before we go. I want you to turn to John, the 17th chapter. John, the 17th chapter, the Gospel of John, chapter 17. And I want you to, in this 17th chapter, two things are obvious. One is, this 17th chapter has to do with his disciples, primarily. Listen, in that entire prayer, he does not mention one single falling short of his disciples, not one single mistake, not one single error, not one single sin, not one single betrayal that was about to happen, not one single ignorance that had already happened. He doesn't say anything except that which is positive and up about his disciples. They've kept your word. They believe that you sent me. All of these positive things that he's reporting to his Father. And he doesn't mention a single negative thing, not one. And then look at verse 23. He prays that we might be one, I in them and you in me, that they may be brought to complete unity, to let the world know that you sent me and that you have loved them just like you have loved me. Do you realize what he's saying? He's praying that we might be united so that the world might believe that God sent him and that God loves his disciples just like he loves his only begotten son. Now that's a stretch as far as I'm concerned. I can't grasp it. But everything about God's a stretch. I don't understand his love. I don't understand his grace. I don't understand much of anything about him except as I see it demonstrated in Jesus Christ. And if in Jesus we see God, and if in the disciples we see ourselves, you can know for sure that you can find in that relationship between him and them, you can find the assurance that you're okay with God even when you miss the mark.